We check in with public broadcasting leaders across the Midwest region. From STPB, today is Thursday, October 9th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we welcome the heads of public broadcasting stations in Iowa, North Dakota, and Nebraska. And we welcome a leader from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. We'll talk about the urgency of partnerships in an America where public media no longer receives federal funding. Plus, a new journalism partnership seeks to fill in the public records gaps in order to better understand missing and murdered Indigenous persons in South Dakota, the trends and the data. And beyond that data, these reporters remain even more committed to centering the stories of families impacted by injustice. That conversation is coming later in the hour. We're broadcasting today from STPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're In the Moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Federal funding through the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, known as CPB, has long served as a lifeline for local public media stations, especially in rural America. Federal funding cuts have raised new questions about how stations will continue to deliver trusted news, educational programming, and community storytelling across the Midwest. Today, I'm joined in the Kirby Family Studio by a panel of public media leaders who understand those challenges firsthand. Stacy Decker is General Manager and CEO of Nebraska Public Media. John Harris II is President and CEO of Prairie Public Broadcasting in North Dakota. Andrew Batt is Executive Director and General Manager of Iowa PBS. And Ruby Calvert is the Chair of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting Board of Directors. They join me to talk about what's at stake for local stations and for the communities they serve if federal support for public broadcasting doesn't return.
This group, you know, when you look at the upper Midwest, we kind of looked around at each other and know we have a lot of things that are in common. A lot of our listeners and viewers with public television and the listeners on public radio have values that are similar, and we thought there were things and opportunities that we could come together and find out what we could do and see if there were opportunities for cooperations, collaborations, and how to go forward in the future, with especially with the rescission that happened recently to public broadcasting.
And so we here on In the Moment have collaborated with Prairie Public before, and your hosts up there of your daily show. Tell us a little bit about what's happening in North Dakota and the impacts that the funding rescission of Corporation for Public Broadcasting will have on Prairie Public so far. What do you know?
Well, at Prairie Public, and I assume you're talking about because of the funding cuts, you know, we started this back in January, February with the state of North Dakota. We lost some state funding from the state, and I think a lot of the undercurrent came out of sort of what was going on in D.C. and at the time. And then with the rescission of the funds that went to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, you know, we've had to, just recently, we eliminated 12 positions, about 18% of our staff, that we had to make that tough decision. A lot of good friends and colleagues are no longer with us, and we hate that, but we're trying to do the best we can to continue to serve the region that we cover. And that's another reason we kind of brought the group together, is that our region, even though we have state boundaries, there's a lot of similarities with the group here.
What did you prioritize to keep? What were you able to prioritize?
Well, the priority was to, and every decision we made and looked at was to continue to serve our community. What could we do? So technically right now, you know, we have not cut any program in particular, but we've got fewer producers, fewer reporters, so we can do less is the big thing. So it's going to impact us. And even as we've talked here, I think it's going to be a year before the system even figures out exactly how much impact it's going to have on us all.
Yeah, Stacy, tell me a little bit about what's happening in Nebraska and how the cuts have impacted your station.
Yeah, we've been very fortunate. Over the years, Nebraska Public Media has been a very fiscally conservative organization, and because of that, we have a little bit of time. We haven't had to lay anybody off yet. I'm meeting with the staff on a frequent basis. Every couple to 3 weeks, we get together and talk about the you know, the challenges that we're facing. From a national level, we're not quite sure yet what's going to happen nationally with content, so we're kind of waiting on that. But we're hoping to be able to invest through some of this and find new opportunities. We've already turned on some things that we haven't done for a long time, and I wouldn't call it like work for hire by any means, but we're creating content in some regard that has a relation to organizations that have mission like we do, and just doing some different things. Have been so fortunate, much like South Dakota, and we've done high school sports for a long time. We've got a relationship with the university. Our governance structure is a bit different. I have a commission, which is governor appointed, and then I have a foundation. I have a relationship with the University of Nebraska, have a relationship with the state. There's a lot of moving parts in Nebraska, but I think widely what we've heard is that we're very appreciated across a number of sectors, news, public safety, sports, as I mentioned, Nebraska stories, and people want to see that continue. So we've increased our fundraising requests, and we've seen an uptick, I would say, from the community support across the state, and that's going to help. Won't cover the loss of $4 million annual in federal funding, but we're working on it, and I think we've got we've made a good start, and our story is out there. People are frequently approaching me about the challenges we face, and I think they've stepped up. I have a little bit of a window, unlike I think John mentioned in North Dakota, and I see it terribly unfortunate that states like North Dakota and South Dakota and a few others have had to lay people off. We're going to stay open. We've been around for 70 years. I want to make sure we're around for 70 more.
Yeah. I think our listeners are fairly savvy at this point, so, and we probably don't have time to go into how all these states have slightly different programs and different affiliations. So I'm just going to refer our listeners back to some of the other programming about how South Dakota works and how it might be different than North Dakota or Nebraska. But let's head over to Iowa and talk to Andrew for a moment. Tell us a little bit about how this past 6 months has impacted your operation.
Well, similar to Stacy, Iowa PBS has historically been very conservative from a budgetary standpoint, but I think it's really important to know when we went through the rescission discussion, so much of it was a national conversation. So much of the impetus was about national programming. And I and many of these other station general managers heard so much positive and still do about what we do locally. But there is some, let's say, irony in the fact that in Iowa, when we lose 18% of our budget, 90% of that cut, so 90% of the cut we have to make up, over $3 million, will come out of local services, local positions, and local programming. That's also what we're working so hard to protect. So even though the national conversation was around some of the national programming, the local programming will take a hit, and that's a theme across so many of our stations. It's also what makes us unique. It makes us represent our state. So for us, we're trying to make sure that we can maintain as much of that as possible, pull back, in some cases, the number of episodes that we do on local series. But it also comes at a time in Iowa where a lot of Iowans have told us for many years that they get to watch all their high school boys state championships on the neighboring states of Stacy's, Nebraska, and up here in South Dakota. This coming winter, we'll be producing all of the boys high school state championships for the first time in our state's history. And so we're dealing with cuts, but we're also going to be providing services we haven't done before. And I think that's really important to maintain for all of us that local presence as much as possible. But there are fiscal realities we all have to confront.
So what is your audience telling you as people are calling in and showing their support that they want more of? And what are they willing to let go of?
Well, most people aren't willing to let go of anything they care about. And what makes public media so interesting is, I think we've all seen it, we have some members and viewers and listeners that really like that one thing, and that's the most important thing to them. So they may not even know half of the other stuff we do. We don't hear a lot of people calling up saying, you should get rid of this. We hear a lot of people saying, we value what you do. We especially value that you are here in our state and that you're covering stories. You're doing historical documentaries. You're showing those high school championships. You are telling the story of agriculture. In our case, we produce a show called Market to Market that covers agriculture in Iowa and across the country. Those are things that we consistently hear. And I think for many of them, we have always been here. And this was a shock to the system and a concern for some of those people that weren't donors before to step up and say, I hear it's at risk. I need to help.
Yeah. This is a great time to bring Ruby into the conversation with the Corporation for Public Broadcasting Board Chair. Help me understand what your role is now. Are you traveling all over the country to different groups like this? Have you come here? What's your main priority right now?
You know, we have been under stress at the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and I think many people and listeners out there may not understand the differences between organizations. I mean, when Congress or when President Trump signed the EO saying no more funding should go to PBS or NPR and gave that directive to CPB, well, you know, that is not our priority. Our priority is to send money that we receive from Congress to local stations like the people who are represented here today. And so we have no power over PBS or NPR. And so their regulations, what they decide to do with their membership and their programming and their content is decided by them. And so I look at CPB, and of course, at this point, CPB is defunded. And our last funding took us through September 30 of this year. And so just recently, last Tuesday, in fact, I was at a ceremony where we released most of our employees. We had approximately 75, and we released all but about 20 of them because we were going to have to finish up grants that we had given out, and that will take through January. And then at January 30th, we'll pretty much be gone. We're having some conversations about what is the merit to continuing the corporation maybe in a more dormant status. Mm-hmm. And I don't know where that conversation is going to go because it does have some monetary requirements. But at this point, the way I look at CPB and what we have done in terms of the overall system is we're the center. You know, the money from Congress comes to CPB and then it's distributed to stations or for things that help station services. That might be music rights. It might be helping with interconnection services. It might be providing professional development for station managers or public affairs people. But when CPB is gone, it's kind of like the center is gone. The system has lost the middle. And I think about a wagon wheel with all the spokes, and all of a sudden you don't have the hub anymore. And I'm concerned about how stations will hold together and what they will create. And so I think it's really exciting that I'm here today with these three really extremely bright young men and in the stations that they're organizing and collaborating. And I think even though we have our challenges today, I think it does provide opportunity. And I'm really looking forward to what these three people will create in terms of more collaborative effort.
What do you think the legacy and lessons are of CPB as you pass that down in a way that, you know, wasn't by your own choice? To say, hey, we got this right. This is something that I hope you remember. And by the way, don't forget these things.
Well, I mean, I recall what E.B. White said in his famous letter in the Carnegie Commission when they actually formulated the Public Broadcasting Act in 1967, and he talked about that stations should be, you know, the place where there are great discussions of content and community service and local programming, and, you know, he was talking about the wasteland of television. And as I look at that, you know, you could still say there's a bit of a wasteland, and I think without us, there would be. But I think the public trusts us, and that's a great response, I think, to our programming and our legacy, is that we still have public trust. It's out there. They trust us to provide the great sports events that these folks are producing, to do the great dialogue with your state legislators. All of that is not something that's going to be done by Fox News or Hulu or the satellite companies that are coming in. We're going to rely on that, our local stations, for that local service. So I really do believe that's the legacy that we have ahead of us.
Do you have a sense of what went wrong or what happened?
That's kind of a dicey question because I think a lot of people, we are so divided as a country in where we think media has been. And while I don't share that same point of view because I don't see the challenges of bias every day. I mean, I look at our systems overall, and I think you have to do that because, as we were talking earlier, you know, maybe if you make 50% of the people happy 50% of the time, maybe you're doing your job. Because I think you've got to have differing points of view, and you're not going to agree all the time, but you have to hear the other points of view. And I just think that's so important in terms of public trust, too, because people want to know what's the other side of the story. And I think that that's something we do well, is provide that point of view. And I think that's what we should continue to do.
Yeah. Stacy, tell me a little bit about the ethics of leadership, you know, sort of bouncing off what Ruby said there. As you go forward, there are political challenges, and there will be 2 years from now and 10 years from now, and there were 10 years ago. But how do you maintain that ethical line in your station? What does that mean to you?
Yeah, so, you know, for me in Nebraska, there's a firewall between myself and the journalists. And I think that's really important that the journalists continue to report on the relevant issues of the day in our state. I personally have been so fortunate to have traveled this country with a responsibility in public media. I grew up here in South Dakota in Watertown. I then worked here at South Dakota Public Broadcasting, went on in Nebraska, was out in New England at WGBH for a while. I had the great fortune of working with Ruby at the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I can tell you all of those organizations hold ethics as a huge and high, high priority of what they do on a daily basis. I can also say the importance of local stations in each of those communities is vast because New England is different than Nebraska, and New England is different than South Dakota and Iowa and North Dakota. And we're serving the communities that we are responsible to in a very ethical way. I've never seen anybody do anything out of bounds in public media. We take this very serious, and I'm very proud to be part of something and have been now for 30 years.
Yeah. That's Stacy Decker of Nebraska Public Media, John Harris of Prairie Public, Andrew Batt of Iowa PBS, and Ruby Calvert, chair of the CPB board. There's more to this conversation after the break. You're on listener-supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Let's get back to our conversation with regional public media leaders. Stacy Decker is general manager and CEO of Nebraska Public Media. John Harris II, president and CEO of Prairie Public in North Dakota. Andrew Batt is executive director and general manager of Iowa PBS. And Ruby Calvert is the chair of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting's board of directors. They joined me in the Kirby family studio in Sioux Falls. John, are you hearing from people in North Dakota, from the audience, from listeners, that they feel there was some kind of betrayal of trust, that there was some kind of bias? Or are you hearing the opposite? Tell me a little bit about how people are responding to that call for public media having been, having lost its way.
Well, obviously, the people that love public broadcasting and have listened to us for all these years or watched us, they've come to our defense. They've upped their contributions. They've brought in more money for us. They want to do what they can to help out. But there's the other side, as Ruby mentioned. I mean, there's always two sides to stories, and truth somewhere in the middle. And that's what, to me, public broadcasting's always been about, is that we try to give a platform for voices to be heard. And for things to be said and conversations to get started. And that's what we want to continue to be about. So, yes, the people that have loved us and been part of us for years are mad and upset or whatever. And so we've had great response to that. But then again, there's the other side that thinks, well, you know, you shouldn't get government funding for whatever reasons. And there is two sides to that. But, you know, we would hope that there would be some common ground and we would come up with solutions for things without being so one way or the other and no way, you know, it's my way or no way.
Do you think there is enough common ground to build upon? Is there enough of a foundation left?
To me, that is part of the problem that we've got. We used to be governed in the middle. We're not anymore. And so it's very difficult to get people to come towards the middle. And that's what we've been struggling with, I think, for a long time.
Yeah. Andrew, tell me a little bit about the way forward. What do you see, especially as you sit here with this team? And SDPB's Julie Overgaard has been in these meetings as well. So the five of you have been, you know, here today. You're going to be here tomorrow having these conversations. What are some of the things that you see are worth leaning into in the future? What is the way forward?
I think the way forward is to not forget your mission, which is what everybody in this conversation is very much thinking about. What's the mission of our station? We're under a lot of stress as a system. Each of our stations are under a lot of stress, but remembering what we do to serve our states and our communities. But when we look collaboratively, we're having a lot of the same conversations. What can we do that we haven't done before that can kind of lock arm in arm and regionally represent and strengthen our stations and be a service to our viewers? Each of our stations aren't here just to exist in perpetuity for our staffs. We're here to serve a community. That's why public media was created. And when I look at what John is focused on in North Dakota or Stacy's focused on in Nebraska, there's a significant overlap in what we do. What can we do that reaches just as many people, if not more? Can we do it a little cheaper? Can we raise revenue? Those are the kind of things that you have to think of as executives of public media stations. And can we be stronger by uniting, whether it be content or engineering capabilities? Those are things that, as a system, those have been out there, but this system has been stable for a very long time by CPB. We have had a major disruption. All of us are interested. Stacy's talking about being around here 70 years. I want to be around here 70 more years too, even if I'm not here for it all. How can we do that? This is a really big inflection point for the entire system, and I think all of us are looking long term, not just at the last few months or the next couple months, but what do the next few years look like and how can we be stronger?
Yeah. And here's one of the things, I don't know who maybe wants to answer this first, but as you have a groups of journalists who are losing their jobs, these are Midwestern journalists who understand. Now, I grew up in Northwest Iowa, and I like to think that I have a good understanding of what, you know, Midwesterners might want to hear. Collaborate with North Dakota a lot. I'm a big follower of the volleyball team in Nebraska.
Oh, yeah.
Because we got some South Dakota girl there. Mm-hmm. But I also don't know exactly. So at the sense, you have all these Midwestern journalists who are really good at reporting and telling stories. Mm-hmm. There seems like there's an opportunity for collaboration. But then also, I'm never going to know Iowa politics like I know South Dakota politics. So there are some limitations to that. So I guess broadly speaking, and maybe all of you want to answer this, how do we collaborate with this cohort of people, but then also maintain that hyperlocal focus, which people in South Dakota are going to tune in for, because they're probably not going to, you know, if you live in Rapid City, Iowa politics is not super important to you. No. So where is that balance going forward? Are we, who has thoughts on that?
I would say this begins at trust. You have this group of people sitting together talking about what the future of public media might look like in the Great Plains region because we trust each other, we understand each other's challenges, and we see the great work that's done in each of our organizations. And to Andrew's point, there is some overlap. You know, there's some duplication, I would call, of things that we do in each of our organizations. But I think outside of that, the opportunity that really exists for us to collaborate even closer, you know, sometimes challenging times bring opportunities as well. And we've got to look at it that way. And I think we are. And that's why we're sitting in a room together trying to figure out what the future of public media might look like and how we might have a hand in creating that new opportunity.
Yeah.
You know, you talk about politics are local, or interests are local. You know, Minot, North Dakota probably doesn't care about what Fargo, North Dakota is doing. You know, we talk about in North Dakota, Western North Dakota versus Eastern North Dakota. And that happens all the time. But at public broadcasting, you know, what I think we're doing is we're helping to preserve the arts, the history, the culture of our region. And now when you start talking about history, a lot of people are interested in history, no matter where it's from. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're interested in things. And you know, whether it's an outdoor show or whether it's another show about an artist or that's doing a different medium, whether it's woodworking or painting or sculptures, people are interested in that. And they probably don't care where they're from. because they're learning something. And so that's what in North Dakota, I always say, we're helping to preserve the arts, history, and culture of our region, and we want to continue to do that.
Yeah. Anything you wanted to add, Andrew, to that?
Your point is well taken that I don't think the folks in Iowa understand what a unicameral is, but the folks in Nebraska have lived that for a long time. That's a politics, public media joke, I guess. But the reality is each of us know our states and our staff know our states. This is, you don't get away from that. That's our superpower, right? That the folks in Nebraska and North Dakota and Iowa, they really know those differences between Minot and Fargo. I'm not aware of them, right? And that's a specialty, but there are similarities. I drove in from Des Moines yesterday, and agriculture is a defining moment. I saw a lot of folks in the field. Issues of agriculture, issues of culture, issues of, each of our states want to have robust businesses and tourism industries. There's things that overlap that don't disappear once you cross a state line.
Yeah. So finding those commonalities and leading into them. That.
Yep.
Let's.
Can I add one?
Yes,
one
please,
thing?
Ruby.
I think these three gentlemen have really captured the specialties of being local. And, we think about local as being one of the most important things. But I guess I also want to mention that I think we do have a lot of promises and obligations in the future. And especially as we're talking about AI and the changes in media, I think public media, public television, and public radio can lead the way in creating not only a good sense for local audiences, but there's a trust factor that's really going to be important in the future. And so I want to stress that public media will be there for that trust. And I really do believe that because we are all local, and you know your local legislators, you know the people who are creating your county commission rules and regulations. And I think that's something that we do so well, and I really do think there is a place for public media in the future, and I don't want to lose that trust and those obligations because I think they're real. Yeah. And I want to see that continue.
Yeah, well said. Let's close with just an idea on the leadership challenge and how as you as human beings and individuals who have the own pressure of your jobs and your lives right now, 5 years from now, what is the 5 year later on you going to tell the person here today? Like, can you look ahead and say, like, this is the leadership lesson for right now that I know is important to, and maybe Ruby, you should start with that. What is the call to leadership today in really difficult, turbulent times?
One of my favorite books is a book called Endurance, where Admiral Shackleton led all of his men across the Antarctica because he knew he could, and he knew that the prize was to get there and to get there with all of his men. And I think that lesson in leadership about being positive, about knowing where we're going, the opportunities that are ahead, and our commitment to community. I think all those things build that leadership component that we all have to remain aware of because it's not going to happen. I mean, our communities are going to be there to support us if we're doing our job. And I do believe that even though times look very difficult right now, I think the times are ahead for us to prove what we can do with less money. I hate to think about that, but we all know it's a reality. But I think it is going to provide for more collaboration, and I think our audiences are going to appreciate that. Wyoming audience may not want to watch the Nebraska unicameral legislature, but I can tell you we'll enjoy a show about sandhill cranes. We'll enjoy, shows about agriculture in Iowa, and I think we all want to know more about our country. And as we celebrate the 250th anniversary of our country here in this next year, it's really important to bring our communities together with that kind of programming, and I think we can do that.
Yeah.
So thank you.
Yeah. Andrew?
Yeah, I think about when you ask about where does the future 5 years want to look back, when I think about for all of us, and I can't speak to what it's like at these individual stations I haven't been at, but we all stand on stations that have been built up over decades. A lot of hard work went into building those networks, building those staffs, building that trust in your state and your community. CPB has helped build that for decades. Where do I want to be in 5 years and say, I am happy we leaned into this and tried to be stronger, which is very challenging to do when you're facing an uncertain budget cut situation, but what are the things that made our station strong today? What can you do to make investments, whether it be regionally or locally? I mean, I'm looking over your shoulder at a statewide map of where this can be, this interview can be heard. You can serve that community because generations of people at this station and others helped build that network. What does that need to look like? You've got to be forward thinking. And it, honestly, it can be a challenge because you're trying to get through the next fiscal year's payroll. You're trying to patch holes in a ship, but you got to be forward thinking, especially in media.
Yeah. John?
Well, you know, again, 5 years from now, I wished I had a crystal ball that could tell me that. But also, I know that, you know, a long journey begins with that first step, and we need to keep moving forward. That I don't want to think 5 years from now, I wished I'd have had conversations. I wish that's why we're doing this type of thing. May not a lot come out of it, but maybe something great will come out of it. It can only do that if we continue to communicate and cooperate with each other.
Stacy, you get the last word.
You know, I think I've got to find comfort in discomfort. I've got to be fearless in a way that I guess I haven't found in some cases. And I think this is what's going to require. I think to be here 5 years from now, I've just got to learn to do things that I wasn't comfortable with a long time, you know, over the course of my career. But I also, we do some things really, really well. And the community has told us the things that we do really well, and you got to double down on those things. I mean, those are the areas where we've got to listen, hear people, and respond, I think, appropriately to the times, and just keep providing people with things that they can trust and enjoy and celebrate.
That's Stacy Decker of Nebraska Public Media, John Harris of Prairie Public in North Dakota, Andrew Batt of Iowa PBS, and Ruby Calbert with the Corporation for Public Broadcasting's Board of Directors. After the break, we'll talk about the reporting of John Hult and Amelia Schaefer on missing and murdered Indigenous people. You're in the moment on listener-supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. A new journalistic project hopes to create a more complete database of missing and murdered Indigenous South Dakotans. We're going to explore the project, its goals, and the partnership that makes it all possible. Amelia Schaefer covers South Dakota's Indigenous communities. She works with the Indigenous news nonprofit, ICT News. She joined us from SDPB's Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in Rapid City. John Hult is a senior reporter with South Dakota Searchlight. He stepped into SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. We made the connections. Here's the conversation.
This all sort of began more than a year ago, actually. I was reporting on drug cartels and former Governor Kristi Noem's comments about drug cartels on reservations. And there was a press conference in the spring, and the governor sort of summoned us all to peer to the conference room, and she sort of doubled down on some comments that she had made that had gotten her in a little hot water with leaders in some of the reservations. And I left that press conference, and I went to Fort Thompson. I stopped there on the way home, and I thought, well, I'll ask some folks how they feel, because that's who we were talking about, people in reservations. Yeah. So I stopped by Crow Creek, and I couldn't find anyone in the leadership. I couldn't find anybody. I walked all around the admin building, and finally I found this open door, and everyone was in the gym, and they were piling up blankets, and they were bringing in food, and they were getting ready for a funeral. The tribal chairman had shut down the whole community to prepare for a funeral for a tribal member. And I thought, that stuck with me, right? Mm-hmm. This is what's going on. No one's talking about, you know, the waltz of political umbrage that I'm going to go and participate in by writing this story about the press conference. And that really stuck with me, just, the support and the closeness and the importance that is placed on members of this community. Because this person did not die in Fort Thompson, died in Brock's Elder. So about a year later, I had an opportunity to apply for some grant funding, and I wanted to look into missing and murdered Indigenous people in South Dakota, because we all kind of know, right? Like, we've seen the red handprint on in the parades, you know, on the horses and the trucks and stuff and on T-shirts, and so we're sort of generally aware that it's an issue. But how big an issue is it in South Dakota? Has it ever been defined? Has it ever been listed out? Has anyone looked into it in sort of a systematic way? And I got the grant, and it basically pays for travel and hotel rooms to get around the state, to actually go and visit places and talk to people. And the connection with Amelia is that the only person who has done that work or started to do that work is her. Amelia has put together a list and she's been working on it for a while. And she's sort of the source of information, the wealth of information at this point. And we wanted to fill that out. So,
Amelia, tell me a little bit about your history reporting on this issue of missing and murdered Indigenous people.
It was right off the bat when I moved here, I began covering MMIP because it's such a big issue here. So when I was working on that, I noticed there were the state website, the Clearinghouse. It's not really, at the time, it's gotten a lot better since then. It is itself pretty new, but it wasn't the most detailed source of information. So I know the first year that I was with the journal, I went to the Victim Services Unit on Pine Ridge pretty often. The walls of that building are completely lined with posters of MMIP victims from Pine Ridge and who are Oglala and didn't die in Pine Ridge, but are Oglala. So that was pretty interesting. So they themselves and Amanda Takes Warbonnet had, she's another advocate, had given me a list of individuals who were victims that, and I wrote the names down from the walls, the posters on the walls. And then for another project, I found myself up in Sisseton and the Sisseton Wahpeton Oyate, where I was able to get a similar list from then, from the tribe. And so I kind of compiled a makeshift database of my own using Flourish with those two victim services units, and then anything that I could find online, the current clearinghouse, and just what other information was out there. So I think that was published April of 2024, the end of the month, near the National Day of MMIW Remembrance, which is May 5th, I believe. Yep. I redid that list again this year, but it's really difficult not having funding to be able to go to all the different reservations. I mean, Sisseton is about 6.5 hours from Rapid City, so I have only gone there once, and I was fortunate to be able to get the list then, but from the nine tribes, I only have two or three lists that I've gotten from the reservations of victims that they know of. And the issue with the State Clearinghouse is it's a really good list of currently missing people, but the police departments themselves have to input that information. Previously, we saw a lot of older cases, like Delema Sitzpor, who went missing about 50 years ago. She wasn't in the database until about 2 years ago, after I did an article on the 50th anniversary of her disappearance. I think she was only 12 at the time, and she went missing on Pine Ridge. It just really showed that there's this big gap in data and collecting data, partially because I think a lot of families have distrust with law enforcement. I think sometimes older cases, especially when we saw the transfer from paper records into digital records, may have gotten lost. I think that was something I heard a lot from the Pine Ridge Police Department. But there's just really not that compiled database of missing people, or especially murdered individuals. There's not really a list of that in the unsolved cases.
Yeah. So there is a missing persons clearinghouse for the Attorney General's office. There is a MMIP Advisory Council, which is now the Stakeholders Committee. There's a MMIP coordinator, Allison Morissette, who was hired in November of 2022. If listeners might remember, there were some challenges about that was approved, but there was no funding for her position, so there was a delay in getting funding. That was a grant that was temporary, I think, maybe like 3 years. So the ongoing funding of that is sometimes in question as well. The fact that there are gaps in the data that we're talking about here is important. Why? Why does the data completion, to have a complete data set, matter?
Because people matter. The people matter. These are South Dakota citizens. These are people that we care about. And it's kind of breathtaking to me, you know, the disparity between white folks who go missing and Native folks who go missing. And I keep coming back to the impact that it has, especially on small communities, when somebody is lost this way. And the idea that we haven't really, in a systematic way, put things together and found these answers, it just bugs me. It just bugs me. Because it's such a big thing, but we don't really know how big, right? Like Amelia was talking about the missing persons clearinghouse, which is, as she said, was just a few years ago. 2020, I think, was the legislation that authorized that. I looked at it about a half hour ago. Mm-hmm. There are 113 people on that list. 70 of them are Native. So that's 62%. And remember, the disparity between inmates and inmates is 40%. 40% Native American, and we're talking about, you know, 9-10% of the state population. And then if you look at, you can break it down by race and gender. 60 of the people on the list this afternoon were women. 42 are Native. That's 70%. And I feel like in this state, with its heritage. I mean, the name of the state, right? We should be paying attention to this. We should know more than we do. And there have been a lot of efforts recently, legislatively and otherwise, to bring attention to this. But I feel like we should have our arms around the scope of the problem, and we should tell some of these stories, and we should try to fill in these gaps, as Amelia's done such a great job working on. So
I want to get to the stories of individual people in a moment, but I want to go back, Amelia, to this idea of data and data analysis of trends and patterns. Why does the data matter? I mean, we know that the lives matter, but when you're looking at putting together a comprehensive list, you also have an opportunity to analyze trends and patterns. What do you see there as potential for the future?
That's a great question. I think that the data itself is important because, one, it's alarming that there's such a comprehensive lack of it. We don't really have a grasp of how big this issue is, especially when it comes to murder victims. I think that it's pretty astonishing. And this isn't just an issue in South Dakota, but it's nationwide. There is no comprehensive data, really, of just how big this issue is. We have a rough estimate. I think the last I heard was about 5,100 victims of MMIP, but we know that's way too low. I mean, there's just such this lack of data. And when you have data, it can help you prove to people, one, how big the issue is. And two, I mean, when John said that statistic of more than 60% of the people who are missing in South Dakota are Native, and especially Native women, that stands out to people. I think that numbers like that really grab attention. And in reporting, it's really useful to have, and to just be able to paint a complete picture of how ingrained this issue is and how it affects all these different communities on and off reservation.
Yeah. Now let's talk about the family stories and being heard and having your loved ones remembered, looked for, found, cases solved, returned home. Tell me a little bit, Amelia, about centering the stories, because people are way more than a number.
Exactly. I think that centering the stories is the most crucial part of this, because while I'm talking about the importance of data, I think it's always, when it comes to data, really important to remember that these are individual people who all have individual stories. They're not just a number. So I think it's really important, and something we plan to carry out in our reporting of this issue is just how much this affects the communities. I mean, John mentioned Crow Creek, which is a pretty small community, but it impacted everyone there. They shut down the tribe, and that's something you see with a lot of these rural areas, is a lot of people, honestly, I think there's something that people say a lot in Indian country, which is there's not one person who hasn't somehow been impacted by MMIP. Mm-hmm. It's pretty rare that you don't know someone who's lost a friend or a relative or just someone they know. So I think it's really important that we really focus on emphasizing the impact this has on individual families and communities, because this issue, it's systemic and it's real and it's huge.
Yeah. And John, that impact is generational, because so many of these victims are mothers, have children, have nieces and nephews.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's huge. And I just, you know, I'm a parent. I can imagine what it's like, you know, if my kids are gone for 2 hours longer than I expected, you know, mm-hmm. it's freaky. Right. And I talked to a mother a couple weeks ago. It's been 6 months. And, you know, just day after day, what happened? Where is he? I don't really know. And just sitting with that, living with that. And then the next generation has to live with that. And the generations before her have these stories. And it just piles up. And that is something that I think we should be ready to sit with. Just the intensity of that on an individual level, and then broadening it out and just realizing how large the issue is. You know, there are classrooms in this state, like Amelia was saying, where people are touched by it. There are classrooms in the state where you can walk in and you can see a group of second graders, and every one of them is going to have a story like this. Mm-hmm. You know, none of us are more than a few hours drive from a place like that. And we owe these folks, I suppose, the dignity, the respect to pay attention and to really sort of try and define this, not just in the data, but in the impact and the way that it feels, and the generational impact, as you're talking about.
What is the goal of your project that you're working on together, John?
Illumination, information. I want the information to live out in the world. I want it to be available. I want people to be able to learn. I want people to be able to search for this information and get something more than sort of a squishy, this is a problem, you know. And it's a problem nationwide. It's a problem worldwide. And in South Dakota, it's a problem like it is everywhere else. And that's not enough. I mean, I feel like we can do better.
Yeah.
That's what I'm looking for.
Amelia? Goals, outcomes, what are you hoping for?
I completely agree. I think also this could be a really good opportunity to build trust with the communities. I remember when I was a senior in college back in Iowa, where I'm from, I did a story on a missing indigenous woman there, Rita Papaki, and there was some hesitancy from the tribe to even talk to media because of the way that her case had been portrayed. So I think this could be a really good opportunity for us to shine a light on the issue in a way that isn't stigmatizing or a way that isn't harmful towards communities would be the goal. And one of the ways we're trying to do that is by gathering as many stories as we can. And so just yesterday we launched a Google form, and I know it's available on the Searchlight website, but it'll soon also be on ICT's website, currently working on that. But it's a way that families can fill out the form, put their relative or friend or whoever's name that they know, mark if they're willing to talk to us, and if they're okay with this being included in the article. And I think that's a really good step towards gathering a lot of good comprehensive data and reaching corners of the state that we might not have been able to before. So I think all in all, this will be hopefully a project that shines a light on how ingrained this issue is in South Dakota, and also a way to bring attention to the things that these families have been going through.
John, what has the response been from officials who might have information, data, police reports, autopsy reports? Have they been responsive to helping you find ways to fill in those gaps?
Well, we're just kind of getting going on that. You know, we've made a few visits. And we've sent out a few information requests. Had some sort of mixed success. Mm-hmm. I just got a records request denial last week. It was kind of frustrating because it would be a big one. And I'm appealing that. It's from the Department of Health. But
is there a reason attached to that?
So anyone, and your listeners maybe know this, but anybody with $15 and access to a courthouse can go to a register of deeds and buy a death certificate, an informational death certificate for anybody who dies in the state of South Dakota. It includes all kinds of information, right? Their age at death, your mother's maiden name, et cetera, et cetera. And one of the things it lists is race. Another is manner of death, which is different from cause of death. Cause is, you know, like it's a gunshot wound, it's cancer or something. But manner of death is natural causes, suicide or homicide. That's a manner of death. It can also be a crime, but it's just one person kills another person, right? So if everyone in South Dakota on or off the reservation has a death certificate filed, and you can go and buy one with $15, that means that there is available a list of, or at least it seems possible that there's available of everyone who's been killed. Every homicide death in South Dakota is there, right?
Mm-hmm.
At least if it's digitized, right?
Theoretically.
Theoretically. Yeah. We don't know how great the data is, how far back it's digitized, but it's there, right? So the denial was related to a South Dakota law that says the database itself shall not be, I can't remember the word, perused. You can't just go and
browse
review the record
or
whatever. But there's also a clause in that very same section of law that says the Department of Health, the secretary, has the ability, if they want, to release this data to public or private agencies. And that's the basis of my appeal. So Secretary Magstad, if you're listening, and I think if we had that, right, it would not be perfect, surely, but we would know how many people have died of homicide. We'd know how many of those people were Native American, and we'd be able to look at some of those disparities immediately, and we'd be able to maybe try and fill in some of the gaps.
Mm-hmm.
And what the database looks like ultimately, I mean, we are trying to make sure that we are respectful and checking all the boxes, making
privacy.
Sure that, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we're, that's something that's right there on our survey. Like, are you willing, right? But having that data would make a big difference. So that was the big denial so far. We've got some information. I got some information from the Sioux Falls Police Department, and we're trying to fill in the gaps on that. But it's coming along.
You just heard from journalists Amelia Schaefer and John Hult. Schaefer is with ICT News. Hult is with South Dakota Searchlight. If you know someone who should be in the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Peoples database, or you want to find out more about this project, head over to South Dakota Searchlight's website and find the MMIP Spotlight. There's a survey there for you to fill out. And that is our show for today. We hope that it served you. In the Moment is produced by Ellen Kester and Ari Youngeman. From all of us here at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.